I'm Chris Vogner, culture critic for the Dallas Morning News, here with the great Skip Hollandsworth, author of The Midnight Assassin. Skip, good to see you.
Thanks.
This is about Austin's, or perhaps America's, first serial killer.
Well, there has to be. There were serial killers in the past. I mean, there were outlaws who killed lots of men. There were maniacs, as they called the psychotic killers, who went on killing sprees just for no reason at all. But I don't think America had ever seen killings like this before, where one man would slip out of his home, stalk a woman, kill her, ritualistically mutilate her, leave her body laying out in the backyard like a work of art, and then disappear in the night and wait until appropriate time had passed to do it again. And he did this over and over and over. And it was sort of the precursor to what we know as modern crime.
And they never caught him.
Never caught him. They tried. They came up with lots of people to arrest, from boyfriends to barefoot black chicken thieves to husbands to even at one point the leading candidate for governor was considered a suspect.
And this is the 1880s?
It's 1884 to 1885 were the killings. So for almost exactly 1 year, Austin was terrorized by an unknown killer who became known by reporters as the Midnight Assassin, who slaughtered women, like making them look like calves at a slaughterhouse. And they were grotesque butcheries. He used axes, knives. He drove iron rods through the ears of the victims like he was lobotomizing them. He bashed in one woman's face with a brick. They were brutal killings, but at the same time, he sort of brilliantly executed them and got away every time, leaving a trail undetected for the bloodhounds. And did this until Christmas Eve, almost 1 year after he started, when he brought the city to a panic by killing two white women at the same time.
And there's a theory that the same person is in fact Jack the Ripper, and that he traveled over to London and started doing it over there a couple years later.
Well, what happened was that Scotland Yard had heard about these killings that had happened in Austin. And a couple of the officials for Scotland Yard began to theorize that perhaps this Texas killer had come to London to become Jack the Ripper. And part of this was a social bias. It was a cultural arrogance among Englanders who did not want to believe one of their own could commit these kind of killings, but certainly a Texan could.
Of course. England is above such things.
Exactly. So Scotland Yard actually went out looking for cowboys to arrest who happened to be living in England at the time.
You spent 10 years working on this, correct?
Well, on and off. It's not like I was working on it every day. There'd be years when I would just go, I give up. Because I was convinced that I was going to find the killer. That if I, you know, I've written some true crime stories for Texas Monthly. So I, Skip Hollandsworth, was going to find this killer and expose this long-held American murder mystery, and I did not.
Yet.
Not yet. But maybe someone will read the book and give me another clue.
So you're a big true crime guy, aren't you? I mean, this is a subject in general that has appealed to you over the years.
I got interested in true crime in the early 90s when I wrote a story about a man in Dallas who is this sort of Renaissance guy, well-liked, well-educated, a portrait painter, a musician, who would slip out of his house at night, shoot prostitutes in the back of the head in Oak Cliff, and cut out their eyeballs. And I became obsessed with him. And I had no idea that I would become so obsessed with this kind of story. I mean, I grew up a very traditional way, the son of a Presbyterian minister, and I suddenly found myself mesmerized by people that walk up to this line and then cross it.
So the wild side of Skip Hollandsworth was unleashed on unsuspecting readers. The dark side of Skip Hollandsworth was unleashed, which led you to the story about Austin's serial killer, which I know you have been working on for a while. You've told me that you're not 10 years straight, but obviously this is a subject that, it's fair to say, has obsessed you.
Well, I kept thinking that if Austin was then a city of 17,000 people. It experienced a kind of killings that had never before been seen in American life. This was a killer that brought the city to the verge of chaos, especially on Christmas Eve when he murdered two prominent white women in different parts of the city within the space of an hour. And how, I kept asking myself, could such a man do so many killings, seven women in all, over 1 year, and no one knew who he was in just this small city? And then I had this conceited, arrogant notion that I could do enough research and go through enough records, enough letters in libraries and in archives and people's attics and look for old documents and find the killer. And it was a long, frustrating, and ultimately fruitless search. This midnight assassin just walked out of history, and today we still don't know his name.
You got a great book out of it, though, so it wasn't...
Well, we'll see.
Entirely fruitless.
We'll see.
Race seems like a very interesting factor here. You mentioned that things really hit the fan when two white women were killed. Before that, it was largely black serving women in Austin, correct?
It was black servant women and one black servant woman's 12-year-old daughter who were murdered. And most of the white community thought this was, quote, a Negro matter, end quote, that some depraved black men, uneducated, had gone on some kind of killing spree. And one killing led another man to do his own killing. And it was a viciously biased kind of attitude that civilized white society had to these killings. Yet, no one seemed to have the slightest suspicion that one person was responsible for all the killings.
Which is kind of amazing, if you think about it.
Well, today, after the second killing, FBI agents from Quantico would be here, the behavioral science unit would be set up, CSI teams would be at work, there'd be all kinds of criminology going on, profiling going on. Back then, there just simply was not the concept that one man would want to ritualistically slaughter one woman after another. I mean, today this is the thing, this is the plot of a million television movies or a million bad movies and bad crime novels, right? Here, it was something that began to slip up on people, and as when it finally dawned on some on Austin society that maybe one killer was responsible for everything, then the whole racial attitude flipped. It was that, well, a black man couldn't be this smart, so it has to now be a white man.
So you just can't win. You're either
no.
too depraved or not smart enough to commit such horrible crimes. During the time you were working on this, on and off for, you know, better part of a decade, was there any part of you that was afraid someone else was gonna get the scoop, as they say?
Constantly. There's all kinds of researchers in Austin. There's a handful of them that work on this case into the wee hours. I call them Austinologists. They're our version of Ripperologists. Ripperologists are the people that you'll see at the public library in London perusing old court cases and files, trying to discover the identity of Jack the Ripper. And, you know, there would just be years when I would think, well, someone else is going to figure this out, and I'm not going to be able to, and I just might as well give the whole thing up. And at some point, I thought, there's no book to be written because I don't have an answer. And then it occurred to me that precisely the opposite was true. The reason to write a book is because there's no answer. It's because this remains one of the great American murder mysteries in American history.
You have all these fantastic details about old Austin, about Austin in the 1880s and before. Obviously, I don't think the internet was invented yet back then. You did some serious research here, and you did some digging, as you know, we used to have to do before Google and before all these wonderful search engines existed.
And I hired researchers.
Well, there's that too. You don't have to admit that, but
but you have to go through article after article in hopes of just finding something. because there's nothing to Google, and there's no Dewey Decimal System for 19th century newspapers, and the newspapers don't have their own indexes. So there could be a front page story one day, and there could be a one sentence story on page four the next day, and if you miss the page four story, that could have a vital detail that helps drive the narrative. And to this day, I'm haunted by what I missed, because I know there's articles out there where there's some record, government record somewhere, that I never saw that perhaps would have led me in even a different direction in writing the book.
Have you put it down? The book is done, obviously. It's right here. It's out. Is there a part of you, do you still go home at night sometimes and tap away a little bit and see if there's anything new?
Well, now I hope someone reads the book and calls me up and says, hey, come see what I've got in my attic.
Be careful what you ask for. One of the other things I really enjoyed was the portrait of Austin in such a time of flux, in such a time of change, kind of coming into modernity, but still a little bit of a one-horse town.
Well, Austin for most, we now think of Austin as this, most cultural of our cities in the state. But for most of its life, Austin was a cow town. It didn't have much of an economy. It didn't have a big state house. It didn't have, the biggest businesses were saloons and a lumber mill. But in the 1880s, the economy in Texas was exploding with the price of cotton, and the coffers in the state legislature were full. And so the state legislature decided to build a state capital, the biggest in the country. A man decided to build, a former Confederate colonel named Driscoll decided to build the world's state-of-the-art hotel called the Driscoll Hotel. Electric lights were arriving. Telephones were arriving. The streets, Congress Avenue, was teeming with horse-drawn carriages, livery wagons, cowboys on horsebacks, and young people riding velocipeds, also known as bicycles. And so what you were seeing right at this time was a city transforming from its sepia-toned frontier past into America's Gilded Age. It was turning into a real cosmopolis. And with this coming of modernity came modern crime.
How did the murders change the city? The culture of the city, the thinking of the city?
Well, because there was so much antipathy toward black men, people still convinced that it was black men that did most of the killings. There was early segregation where the blacks were moved out of white neighborhoods. But there was a fear of the dark. And one of the things I suggest that's very controversial and that some Austin history buffs think I'm wrong on is that these moonlight towers that you see scattered around Austin were built even 10 years after the crimes were committed to try to light Austin at night to keep the midnight assassin or another midnight assassin from reemerging and haunting the city like he did back in 1885. That makes sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think so.
Good luck. Good luck on that transcription, whoever's doing it.
Sounded good to me, man. That's all that matters. Were you surprised that this story was so little known over the years?
Mesmerized. I'm not the first person that's done this, but you go through the microfilm and you come across a headline that reads, "Blood, blood, blood. The demons are after Austin's white people," or "Bloody Night of Terror, the demons strike again." And you think, is this, how could this have been ignored? But the fact is that the story has never been in any Texas history books, any American history books. It's mentioned in a few places, almost in footnotes, in crime histories of America. And it's a tale that almost feels novelistic. There's scandal, panic, there's beautiful women, there's baying bloodhounds, there's political corruption, there's bumbling police officers and private detectives, there's corruption.
All this is all put together in one phenomenal tale, and it's true.
Let's talk a little bit about another true crime story, the Bernie Tita saga. You co-wrote the screenplay from the movie Bernie with Richard Linklater, starring Jack Black and Shirley MacLaine. And the Bernie Tita trial is about to get cooking here in the coming days. Where do we stand with good old Bernie and what's happening there?
Well, the prosecutor with the state attorney general's office that's taken over the case has zero sympathy for Bernie. She has said in her opening arguments that he is a con man who deliberately preyed on other wealthy women before he preyed on Mrs. Nugent, and that she trusted him implicitly, she loved him dearly, and he completely manipulated her. So it's a full on-scale onslaught to try to make Bernie look like a remorseless killer who, according to the prosecution, shot Mrs. Nugent as she was leaning over to pet her dog in the garage and then stood over her and shot her a couple more times. That's clearly a different portrayal than what was portrayed about him that led to the movie. So we're seeing a whole new picture of Bernie that was not shown earlier on in press reports or in the first trial. On the other hand, the defense is really making an argument that the real Bernie that the real Bernie was a young man who had been viciously sexually abused as a boy and as a teenager, who had what psychiatrists who've analyzed him describe as a dissociative personality disorder, and that when he got involved in another abusive relationship, even if it was verbally abusive by an older woman, and the defense argues that she was very abusive to Bernie, that at some point he snapped, and the dissociative personality that he had compartmentalized came out in this sort of one act of crazed rage, and that he should be forgiven for what he did, that he served enough time.
What do you think?
I'm going to wait it out. I'm going to totally wait it out. I mean, what fascinates me is that we're coming on 20 years since that murder took place, and still people are debating who was the real Bernie and who was the real Mrs. Nugent.
In the film, as you're saying, and in the stories that came out back then, there is a real sense that the community in East Texas, they're really liked this guy and thought he was very charming.
Well, the film was not an activist film. There was nothing in there to try to get people to think, oh, this is too bad that Bernie's in prison for life. The film was really about how a community rallied around a killer because they loved him and they did not like Mrs. Nugent. And the facts of that still remain undisputable, that Bernie was the most popular man in town despite his feminine personality and despite his sort of peachy sweet manner, as someone described it. And Mrs. Nugent was just disliked because she had a very sour disposition. Did that mean Bernie should have shot her? Of course not. But the black humor of Linklater's movie was how the town rallied around Bernie.
And I'm assuming we will be reading your coverage of the trial in the near future.
Absolutely.
In Texas Monthly.
Absolutely.
Looking forward to that. And The Midnight Assassin is in bookstores as we speak.
As we speak.
If I am not mistaken. Or on Amazon or wherever one buys books these days. Virtual sites or brick bookstores along many roads. Skip Hollinsworth, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Mr. Chris.